In the New Testament, in the book of James, some very familiar verses share a difficult thought. In the first chapter, second verse, we read, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith develops perseverance." How much does it cost for you to serve Jesus Christ on a daily basis? Now, I'm not talking about a price in dollars and cents. What I mean is, what kind of testing has your faith gone through? On today's edition of Focus on the Family, we're going to see just how high that price has risen for a group of believers. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout. Doctor?
Mike, we're going to meet some very precious people today who have paid an enormous price for their faith and for answering the call of God on their lives, and I want our listeners to know them and remember to pray for them in the days ahead. That is one of the motives for doing this broadcast today.
I've just met them a few minutes ago, but I've read about them for months now in anticipation of this conversation, and I appreciate who they are and especially what they've been through.
We're talking about three women, three wives and mothers, who have served as missionaries with the New Tribes Mission, translating the Bible and leading Bible studies among the Kuna people of Pucuro, Panama. I hope I pronounce it right.
Yes.
All right. That's a tiny village of 300 people in the middle of a rainforest in Panama, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But let me introduce these three first, and then I have another guest to introduce. Nancy Mankins. Nancy is married to Dave. They have two grown children. The Mankins began working in Panama with the New Tribes in
1984.
Next is Patty Tenenoff. Patty is married to Rick. They have three children, ages 5, 8, and 13. And you first moved to Panama in?
1986.
And then third is Tanya Rich. Tanya is married to Mark. They have two small girls, ages 5 and 7 still?
Yes, that's right.
All right. And they moved to Panama in 1991, it says here.
Yes.
All right. Also with us is another missionary, Ray Rising, whom we'll hear from a little bit later. He's married to Doris, who's here with you,
right.
Ray, is that correct?
And right.
In the gallery. And you have two grown sons,
right?
Obviously, I'm just now getting acquainted with these folks as well. We met just a few minutes ago. Ray, you still work with Wycliffe?
That's correct.
But for now, let's start with the three ladies and get their story, and then Ray, I'm going to come back to you. With regard to your work with New Tribes Mission in Panama and what took place there. First of all, what did the village look like? Kind of give us a setting for where you were called to work in the 80s and early 90s.
The village of Pucuro is nestled in the rainforests of Panama. It's a village of about 300 people, and it's very, very isolated. There isn't any electricity or running water. The people there are just a beautiful people who really are inquisitive and love to learn about the world around them. And we just grew to love them very, very much. And we went there to learn their language and to translate scripture portions in their language and teach them the gospel of Christ.
Tanya, were they open and receptive to the gospel?
Yeah, Mark and I really felt they were. We had only lived in the village for about 6 months before Mark was taken, but we had already grown to just love the people. We had made good friends, and they loved to laugh when we made mistakes speaking their language and did stupid things, you know, trying to live out there in the middle of the jungles. But we just loved the people. They were friendly and warm.
Now, Patty, women are nest builders, home lovers, especially those who have three children, as you do. And what was it like to pack up and go to a rainforest in Panama with people you didn't know and trying to adjust to a radically different culture in that way? Was that hard for you?
I definitely had to adjust. I enjoyed living in the United States, and it was my husband that was called to be a missionary first, and he just prayed and prayed for me, and eventually I felt the Lord leading for me to be missionary with him, you know. And it was an adjustment time, just so many changes. But I noticed that when I got before the Lord and asked him what he wanted for my life instead of struggling what I wanted for my life, then there was a peace there.
Let me ask the other two of you the same question. That is a tough assignment. I think maybe more for a woman than a man, typically, because men are adventuresome and they want the new challenge and they enjoy going to new settings. Women are often a little reluctant to experience change and uncertainty and newness in that way. Was it hard for you all? Tanya, was it hard for you?
Well, actually, I kind of felt like I was going back home. I grew up in Bolivia, South America. My parents are missionaries, and my grandparents also were missionaries. So really, when we got to Panama, I kind of felt like I was back home. And then when we actually moved out to Pucuro, I even felt more at home because I grew up in the jungles of Bolivia. So for me, it was really neat. And there were differences with the culture of the people, but it was kind of like what I grew up with. So it was exciting, and we really loved it there.
So for you, coming back to the United States and all of the comforts that we have was more of a change than staying in the jungle.
After Mark was taken, I went through more adjustments coming back here to the States. I never lived on my own here in the States, and it was very hard with two small children.
Nancy, how about you?
Well, I grew up in Chicago. And it was a big adjustment for me to not have running water and to just the living conditions at first, and yet it was a challenge. But I think the hardest thing for me to adjust to was the fact that you're always starting all over, learning a language. We went to Panama, we learned Spanish, and then we went to Pucuro, and we started again to learn the Kuna language. And I think not being able to communicate was harder for me than the living conditions. And yet that makes it easier to desire and to learn the language.
How long were you there?
We were there for 7 years.
And you learned the language.
Yes.
You learned to communicate.
Yes.
You made friends with the people.
Yes.
Did it start to feel like home to you?
Oh, it really did, yes. I loved it there. In fact, that was one of the hardest things, was just leaving the people that we loved and not knowing if we'd ever go back.
The other two of you also learned the language?
We were there 5 years. I wasn't fluent. But I was learning, still learning, you know. And Rick had actually passed a level test to where he could start teaching Bible lessons. And it was real exciting days that we had there in Pucuro.
Mark and I were just learning Kuna, so, I mean, we were still, like, in the stages of everybody laughed every time we opened our mouths, you know, trying to communicate. But it was fun, and we knew Spanish, both of us did, so, and the Kuna knew enough that we could communicate a little bit at once.
Well, it was on January 31st, 1993, coming up now, Mike, on 5 years, that an event took place there in that little village that changed your lives. Help tell the story.
Well, it was January 31st, and it was a Sunday, and we had had a believers' meeting. And in the village there, our homes are not close together. The missionary houses, one at one end of the village, one at the other, and ours was on the outskirts of the village. And as it got dark that evening, Dave and I were sitting in our hammocks on either side of the front door, and Dave was listening to the news on his shortwave radio, and I was reading a book. And I remember Dave saying to me, "Do you hear someone coming?" And I leaned real close to the screen, and I said, "No, I don't hear anything, and I don't see anything. I don't see a light." But just that quickly, three men burst in our door with machine guns, and they leveled them at my husband. Well, right away, his mind went blank. They were yelling something at him, and he stood up, and they were yelling, "No, no," and hitting him with the butts of their guns. And so he sat back down, and they yelled again, and he stood up. And for me, it's just like the Lord made me very, very calm. And I remembered from 4 years ago at a refresher course, stay calm. The first few minutes are the most dangerous. And as I was sitting there in my hammock, I realized that Dave wasn't understanding them. So I said, "He doesn't understand you. He'll do whatever you say. Please show him what you want him to do." And at that point, they seemed to calm down a little, and they showed him. They wanted him to sit with his face to the wall, and they tied his hands behind his back. One man held a machine gun to his head, and another man went and shot a warning shot out the door. I remember seeing Dave just jump and all of the blood draining out of his face. At that point, I'd been praying, "Please let it just be us," but I heard another shot from where the Tinanoff's house was, and another shot from where the Rich's house was, and I realized that they had captured all three homes. And this wilder man said, I want your money," and I thought, "I really don't want to go upstairs, but I'd better do what they say." So I walked up the stairs with both men following me, and I got about to the second stair from the top, and I grabbed my purse. I knew right where it was, and I turned around and faced them, and the one man said, "Go up the stairs," and I said, "No." And he said, go up the stairs. And again, I said, no. But I handed my purse around him to the second man, and he ran down the stairs with my purse, the other man following him. And they began to fight over the contents of my purse, and I walked around to where Dave was. And very much against Latin culture, I followed this man around the house looking at him, saying, when are you bringing my husband back?
Did you think you might be killed?
Or I don't think that I felt personally like that I would be killed. I felt threatened going up the stairs with these two men, but no, I didn't feel like they were going to kill me, but I really at that point realized they were kidnapping my husband. Mm-hmm. And of course I didn't know what would happen.
And then they took him.
They took him. That was the last time I saw him. The last words he said, they said, have faith, this will be over soon. And the last words that I heard him say were, I do have faith, it's in the Lord Jesus Christ. And he walked out the door.
Tanya, what was your experience? You were at the other end of the village.
Yeah, we were at the other end of the village, and it was kind of similar. We were in our hammocks on either side of the front door also, and I had just gotten up and put the girls in bed. I had Jessica in the hammock with me. She was 11 months old, and I put her in her bed and kind of came back out into the living room, and I saw laundry that needed to be put away and dishes that needed to be done, and I thought, it's getting dark, I need to hurry. And the thought crossed my mind, I should go get Tamara, who was with her dad in the hammock, and put her in her bed. And just like the self-sacrificing mother that I was, I thought, Mark is strong. He can get up and put her in her bed when he wants, you know. But it was just kept nagging me. So I walked over and picked Tamara up and put her in her bed. And just as soon as I did that, we heard loud noises outside the door. A 13-year-old Kuna girl who had become a good friend of mine went towards the door to push it open. And as she pushed it open to see what was going on outside, three men burst in our door with guns and started yelling to my husband in Spanish, siéntate en el piso, manos arriba, sit down on the floor, put your hands up. And Gilbertita came and grabbed me and pulled me back into the girl's bedroom so we could only hear what was going on out in the front room. And I heard a gunshot, and then I heard silence, and my heart sank, and I thought they had killed Mark then. I waited a few seconds, wishing I could just disappear. You know, it's like I wanted to go run somewhere to get help, and there really wasn't anything to do. So I sat there and started praying with Gilbertita in Spanish, and then I heard footsteps coming back through the house. Our houses were built up off the ground and on wood floors, and I could tell, I remember thinking, he's come across the river because there's water in his boots. And it was that kind of squishy sound echoing back through the house, and he kept calling me, Señora, Señora, and I wanted to get up and just, like, go out of the bedroom so he didn't have to see the girls, and I couldn't even move. So he came in the bedroom and shone his flashlight around, and finally then I was able to say, here I am, and what do you want? He said, give me your money, all your money. So I started going into our bedroom, and at that point went out of the girls' room and looked through the kitchen and into the living room, and I saw Mark laying face down on the floor with his hands tied behind his back. And he kind of started to struggle when he saw me heading towards the bedroom with this man following me. And they had been yelling, don't speak in English, you know. But I just turned to him, and it was almost like the Lord stopped their ears for a few seconds. And I just said, honey, I'm okay. They haven't touched me. And that was all he needed to hear just to be able to calm down and relax a little bit. So from there, I just followed all their orders. And Nancy talks about this class on terrorism and how to be a good hostage and all of that. And I think I joke and say I was working in the nursery the day they gave that class, because I don't remember anything of that class. But the Lord really looked out for me anyway. At one point, the gorillas asked me for some sugar because they were taking different food things. And I went into the pantry, grabbed a pound of sugar. And as I walked out, I saw a stack of these plastic grocery store bags with a handle. And I grabbed one, and before I even realized what I was doing, I asked this gorilla, do you want a bag to put your stuff in? And he just stopped everything and looked at me like, lady, you are so strange, you know? But from that point on, he kind of came in between me and some of the other gorillas that were wilder and crazier. And shortly after that whole thing took place, I had packed all of Mark's clothes. They told me, pack all of his clothes. They said, come on, we're leaving. And that's about when we heard the shots from the other parts of the village, and we realized they had all of us. And they made me leave the house. Mark and I both leave the house. And I had to ask the 13-year-old girl if she would watch the girls for me. The girls miraculously had stayed asleep the whole time. Mm-hmm. They never woke up with the gunshots and the yelling and everything. And that I really believe that was a miracle. Mm-hmm. Thank the Lord for that.
And so they took you part of the way?
Well, they led Mark and I through the village, about 5 or 10 minute walk up to the Mankins' house, and we stood outside when some of what Nancy described was going on. We saw some of that happening in their house, and then I saw them lead Dave out, and then they told me to go into the Mankins' house, and they led Mark away. Mm-hmm. So that was the last time I saw him there.
Patty, let's hear your story.
This was about 7 o'clock at night, and it was already dark, and in my house we had 2 kerosene lamps lit. One was in the on the dining room table, and one was back in the children's room. And I had just finished reading devotions with our 2 younger children. Our older child was 8 years old, and she was away at the MK boarding school. And so after devotions, the 2 little ones, they were 1 and 3 years old, walked down the hall, and Daddy was laying in a hammock talking with a Kuna man. And every night we did this, he would always excuse himself from whatever conversation he was having and hug and kiss his children goodnight. So I stood there waiting, just so proud of my little family. And so they hugged and kissed goodnight, and then we went back to the bedroom. And I was tucking them into bed, and actually tucking in the mosquito net, when I heard a scuffle in the living room, and my husband yelled something in Spanish. So I didn't think too much of it. I thought, with it being Spanish, there probably are some Latins in the village from downriver. But then there was more scuffling, and he yelled in Spanish again. And I thought, what is going on out there? Maybe there's a drunk, and he's handled drunks before. He can take care of himself. But then he yelled a third time. It was in English, and I could feel the panic in his voice, and by now I was sitting on the bedroom floor holding my 2 children, wondering, did he want me to go out there? Should I go out there? So I got over to the door, and I looked down the hallway, and I could see that Rick was laying face down on the floor with a gorilla leaning over him, tying his back. The gorilla's gun was on a sling over his shoulder. And right away I knew. I leaned back in the bedroom, and I just felt like Rick would not want his children seeing him that way. So I didn't choose that moment to go out there. Next thing I heard was footsteps and the door closing, and then the gunshot, along with the gunshot from upriver, and then the one from the Rich's house. Well, then the Kuna men, my house just filled up with Kuna men, and they were all telling me different things. I understood from them that gorillas had even taken Tanya and Nancy, so I felt I was there all by myself with the children. And in our house was the two-way radio that we had communications with in the city. So some of the Kuna men were yelling at me to hide this radio. So I went over to the radio, and in my mind I thought, you know, Patty, you might have to hook this radio back up again. Well, this is Rick's department, not mine. I didn't know anything about this radio. So I looked at it, and I started from top to bottom, and I unhooked this one, unscrewed this one, you know, and I'm memorizing this procedure here. So I took the radio, unconnected the radio, and the Kunas were saying, hide it, hide it. Well, they wanted me to hide it in the house, and I thought, well, if I'm going to hide it in the house, I wouldn't have even disconnected it. So they said, okay, we'll hide it for you. And the last I saw of that two-way radio was in a plastic bag, a Kuna man taking it out of the house.
You think the gorillas got it?
Yes, there was. We later recognized that a gunshot went off when we feel they confiscated the two-way radio, the gorillas then. Mm-hmm. So then, next thing I know, I knew I didn't want to stay in the house by myself, so I was putting some things into a bag for the children and I to go stay in a Kuna house, a mosquito net, clean sheet, you know. And I turned around, and all the Kuna men were gone, and walked 2 gorillas. And they were both yelling at me. They wanted the radio, they wanted money, they wanted food they could eat in the jungle, they wanted Rick's boots, they wanted me to pack a suitcase for him. And the older one seemed more in charge, so I focused on him. This class that Nancy and Tanya talk about, I don't even remember one. So I don't know where. It must have been the Lord that told me, Patty, focus on this one that seems to be in more control. And he was telling me to pack a suitcase for Rick. So I went to the bedroom, which is dark, and picked a suitcase and took it out to the dining room, and I put the suitcase on the table, and I walked back and forth from the living room to the kitchen packing the suitcase, carrying my one-year-old, and my three-year-old was holding on to my skirt the whole time. And they were systematically ransacking through the whole house. And at one point, we were in the process of picking pictures for a prayer card, and I grabbed one of those, and I picked up my New Testament that Rick had given me on our honeymoon, and I put the picture in the New Testament, and I took that out and put it in his suitcase. So then they were done with the house, and I was done packing this suitcase, and the younger one took off carrying Rick's boots, and the older one picked up his suitcase. And I followed him to the door, and I said, "When will I see my husband again?" And he told me, "Very soon we will arrange it." And I really believed him. I believed his word that night. But over these past years, the Lord's really been teaching me that it's God's word that I can only trust.
And his timing. That's been 5 years.
Almost
5 years. Another couple of weeks. Who were those gorillas? What do you know about them now?
No, they didn't identify themselves that night, but we believe that it's a group called FARC. It's the acronym stand for the Spanish name Fuerzas Armadas Revolucionarios de Colombia, a revolutionary armed forces group of Colombia, who have taken the blame or the credit for having our husbands now.
They have admitted that they have them.
Right, they have.
And they are at war with the Colombian government.
Yeah.
So their quarrel was not with you or with America, but it was with the government, and they're using your husbands as hostages for ransom. Is that correct?
That's right. They demanded $5 million ransom in the first few days after they took them, but that's one thing that's so hard to understand. Their quarrel, their war is with the Colombian government, and it's very hard to understand why this happened to three American families.
Mike, the clock is so inconvenient to this program. You know, 30 minutes goes by so quickly. Here we have the three of you in a rainforest without your husbands, and yet two of you have little children with you. And what do you do now? And even your money and everything's been taken, your radio for communication. And we need to know the rest of the story, and we're going to have to wait to hear it till next time. And Ray, we haven't even heard from you yet, because you are also a missionary, and you were held hostage yourself, weren't you?
810 days.
810 days. We will get to your story next time, and we will hear the balance of those other three stories tomorrow as well. I want to say to our listeners again, Mike, that these ladies still need our prayers. Those men are still out there someplace.
Absolutely.
As best we know.
Mm-hmm.
And you all have reason to believe they're alive?
Yes, we do.
Yeah. But you're not certain of that.
The last proof of life we received was December of 1993.
And that was via a radio message that was played for us with our husbands' voices on it. Mm. But we weren't able to respond to it. We didn't talk to them.
But you did recognize their voices.
Yeah.
What did they say to you?
They sent their greetings and their love to us as their wives and their children. They let us know that Bible verses were special to them, and that they were encouraged in the Lord, and that they were being taken care of in the aspect of food and shelter. Did they mention
water,
shelter?
Water.
Yeah,
water to drink and food to eat. Yeah.
Basic requirements.
Real basic, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's been a long time.
Oh, it's been 4 years ago now.
Too long.
And the years are dragging on, and the children need their daddies, and you all need your husbands. And the Lord cares about this issue. He cares about you. And I'm just going to ask our listeners to really hold you up in prayer. And be sure to be listening next time, because we're going to hear the balance of the story and where the issue rests at the moment. Thank you all for coming to be with us. I really am sorry to interrupt at the end of the broadcast here, but we don't have any choice about that, do we, Mike?
No.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much for having us and for praying. Thank you.
Well, again, we will come back and conclude our conversation with our four guests when Focus on the Family is next on the air. I hope you'll be able to be with us.
This program is provided by Focus on the Family. Our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.